I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. This summer, kids in South Carolina reported that a group of clowns was trying to lure them into the forest. A woman told the police she saw a clown waving at her from under a streetlight. Pennsylvania State Police reported that these and other recent sightings were fueling a clown panic, driven in part by the media coverage. Well, we've been following this phenomenon, wanted to know more about why clowns creep us out, why they can be so scary, and what to make of all these sightings. We asked Stephen Schlossman to join us. He's a fright film fan, also associate director of the Clay Center for Healthy Young Minds at Massachusetts General Hospital, and he's an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And Stephen Schlossman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So why are people afraid of clowns?
It's a wonderful question. So I don't think they're afraid of clowns so much in the circus, although they're still a little creepy in the circus, but a clown in your backyard is scary, and that's part of the secret. It has to do with context. It's where things belong. It's when patterns are off. So in general, a clown is recognizable. We've seen it before. But the pattern with which they're showing themselves to us in this current, you know, quote-unquote epidemic, that's different. And I think that's what's freaking people out, at least in the current episodes.
Are we in a quote-unquote epidemic?
Yes. From a CDC epidemiologic term, no. But from a popular culture all over the internet meme kind of way, yeah, it's everywhere, including across the ocean. There's been stuff in the United Kingdom as well.
So does this come in waves, like weird clown sightings? Is it a form of hysteria? Is it contagious?
I love these questions. So I only loved it because I've been wondering the same things. So you can talk about it in terms of a contagion in the way that that social media propagates contagions. So my guess, and I don't know for sure, is that initially there was probably some element of viral marketing, some element of people just messing around, dressing up as clowns, understanding that it's, you know, a little bit creepy or a lot creepy. And then other people start copying it, and then you get this kind of bar that keeps going up, and folks try and jump higher and higher to meet that increasing standard of creepiness that clowns already readily bring to the table.
I was reading in some of these communities, people are truly scared, and there was a description even of some neighbors getting their guns together. I'm not sure they're going to go out and shoot people, but feeling that they needed to arm themselves for fear of clowns.
Yeah, no, so I read those descriptions also. In fact, when I was first asked about this, it was to the things you referenced down in South Carolina and Greenville. And there were people, you know, with their firearms out, ready, sort of aiming them towards the woods, looking for motion. That's actually a big horror trope when you think about it. Horror movies, including movies with scary clowns in them, are never about the creatures themselves. They're about how folks react to them. And usually it ends poorly because people get a little hysterical. So when people are pointing their firearms into the woods and shooting at things that move, or even thinking of shooting at things that move, probably someone's going to get hurt.
Absolutely. Well, let me give out the phone number, which is 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about creepy clown sightings with our guest, Stephen Schlossman. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I remember when my son was little, he was a toddler, the first time he saw a clown, he was terrified. He grabbed my leg and, you know, hid his face in my leg, but then he would peek out and take a look at the clown, and then he'd turn his head away. Is that a typical toddler reaction, do you think?
Yeah, it is. It's a really great example of the way folks will debunk sometimes the postmodern telling of why clowns are scary. A lot of people will point to the changing of clowns as fun characters, like in circuses and then later in rodeos. During the 19th century, there's a lot of novels around the times that Dickens was writing where there were clowns who became kind of creepy characters, notwithstanding the more recent creepy clowns like John Wayne Gacy, you know, who were obviously horrible people. But it turned, you know, there's no way. My daughter did the same thing, both of them, and they never read Dickens when they were 3 years old. So I think it's that pattern recognition. You've got two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. You recognize it as human, and yet the features are so grotesquely off that you do a double take. And you do a double take way before you know why you do that double take. It's a very primitive response. It's an adaptive response because you're looking for things that don't look like they fit in.
I'm also thinking just the thought of someone literally having a frozen smile on their face. I mean, there's something really unsettling and clearly unnatural about that.
Yep. Any frozen expression tends to set people off. That's a very common horror trope. I teach a course on horror films at the undergraduate level at Harvard, and we often talk about this. So whether it's a frozen blank face, a frown, or a smile, the absence of any change of emotion in that nuanced way that we look for cues freaks people out. So that smile that's there all the time just plain doesn't make sense outside of the context of the circus. So the suggestion is that there's something that's being hidden. What's behind it?
And it's the thing that's behind it that's so scary?
Yeah, because you can't read it. We don't get those clues that we look for all the time when we see people.
I ran across a great quote from Federico Fellini, the grand filmmaker. He did a documentary called The Clowns, and he describes being a little boy seeing clowns. And let me just quote a couple of things that he says. He says, "The clowns didn't make me laugh. No, they frightened me. Those chalky faces, those enigmatic expressions, those twisted, drunken masks, the shouts, the crazy laughter, the absurd, atrocious jokes, they reminded me of other strange and troubled characters who roamed around every country village." Of course, this was the 20th century, probably small villages in Italy. But I thought his description was just so vivid and it felt so real.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I've not seen that quote, but I now am going to shamelessly steal it and use it in my course and attribute it to both you and Fellini.
No, just give it to Fellini. That's it. He's the one that deserves it.
I'll give it to Fellini. No, it's great because it can't help but to conjure up that feeling that something is a little bit off, in the same way that Fellini's referring to the people in these small villages who strike you as a little bit off. And that fear of the unfamiliar is a very common human feature. It's something that people who've been telling scary stories, and we've been doing that since we've been telling stories, they use that all the time. That's how you know the story's about to get scary. Things are a little bit off.
I'm thinking about comedy and tragedy, perhaps even humor, fear. Are they flip sides of each other?
Yeah, there's a whole body of neurobiologic literature that examines the way your brain responds to jokes and humor and the way your brain responds to fear and anxiety. And it's almost the same neural pathways. So it's these pathways that start usually initially in the more primitive regions of the brain that have been, from an evolutionary standpoint, online much longer. And then it kicks it north to the more cortical parts of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, that sort of tries to make sense of it. We do this with jokes, and we do this with scary things. Mm. And in fact, in a very similar way, nothing makes a joke unfunny like telling you why it's funny. Like you explain the reason a joke's funny is something funny. If you tell somebody why a clown is scary, they actually start to be a little bit less scary. You sort of start to deconstruct them a little bit. It doesn't work quite as well if the clowns keep showing up. I mean, you can tell people all you want, but if I saw a clown in my backyard today, I think I'd bring my kids in and send my dog out.
Sure. So you think there are real creepy clown sightings happening?
Oh yeah. So I think there's like a lot of these things when they happen, I think there's a percentage of these which are people thinking they see something when they don't. So that's what you would call an illusion, where something appears different than from what it is. I don't think there's hallucinations, but I do think there's also people who, for fun or for some whatever, kind of twisted reason, or just because it's the Halloween season for kind of a practical joke, are dressing up as increasingly creepy clowns and wandering around. There's also a couple of remakes coming out. Most importantly, Stephen King's movie, or his book, It, was made into a made-for-TV movie about 20 years ago, and now it's being remade. And that's on people's minds also. So the notion of a creepy clown is wandering around the horror canon right now.
Does part of us like to be scared, though?
Oh, absolutely. No, that's a key part of the course. I hope it's like normal, since I sure like it. It's like say it's normal. Yeah, there's a really interesting literature on why people like being scared. And I don't mean scared like being in a war zone scared. That's really different. I mean scared like going on a roller coaster ride or going to a haunted attraction or watching a scary movie. It's not just that we enjoy the fight or flight response that our brain wanders into, even though you know it's safe when you're in a movie theater. It's then the action of thinking about why you're scared. That's the part that people really enjoy. So it's called a metacognition. So it's not just, am I scared? It's, well, why did that issue or that image particularly scare me. That's the game that a lot of horror fans like to play.
And it's obviously within the safety of their living room watching TV or in a movie theater.
Yep. So that's why when these things that, you know, should be in your living room on the TV screen or in the movie theater find their ways into the woods in real life, first of all, that's why it's a news story. And also that's why it becomes that much more creepy, because then what we've, you know, safely displaced into the world of fantasy has made its way into our reality. And we don't like that much.
Do you think these sightings are giving clowns a bad name?
Yes. I actually have received notes from friends who I've met on, you know, online through social media and things through my when I write about horror, and a couple of professional clowns who really, you know, they entertain at birthday parties, and they say, "Can you please just rescue us from this? We are people who all our lives enjoyed making people laugh. We had to work really hard to learn to juggle. Can you please like make us a little bit less sinister in some of these news contests?" So yeah, I think in general, clowns are, you know, wonderful things that show up in circuses and rodeos. I remember seeing when I was growing up, but they sure lend themselves to being creepy fairly easily.
And is there, we're almost out of time here, a connection between court jesters and clowns?
Yeah, so there is this interesting body of literature looking at the origin of the court jester, who actually had a pretty rough job. I mean, he had to make the king laugh, and the king was fairly spoiled, or the queen, so it wasn't so easy to make him laugh. And if they didn't make him laugh, they would be put to death, so it was an awful lot, or at least be harmed, so it was an awful lot at stake. And they had their face altered, sometimes mutilated, such that they couldn't not smile. So it has this kind of gory history behind it that may or may not, depending on what history you read, have led to the evolution of clowns. And I think a lot of it builds on that, and that cultural memory.
Well, that seems like a horror film in and of itself.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, well, most horror films come from things that are real, and you just either tweak them or exaggerate them just a little bit. Because to be horrifying, it has to be familiar. It has to be something we've seen before.
Well, Stephen Schlossman, thank you so much for joining us at AM Radio Time to talk about these creepy clown sightings.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks
You're welcome.
For having me.
You're welcome. Associate Director of the Clay Center for Healthy Young Minds. That's at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's also an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And this is something, obviously, we could not resist. Who could resist Krusty the Clown's rendition of Stephen Sondheim's very famous song, Send in the Clowns.
Send in the clowns, those daffy, laffy clowns. Send in those soulful and doleful schmaltz by the bowlful clowns. Send in the clowns.
They're already here.
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. When you travel, do you choose the popular tourist sites, or are you the kind who likes the weird and wonderful and quirky places? Ella Morton and Joshua Forer are two of the authors of a new book called Atlas Obscura, an explorer's guide to the world's hidden wonders. It includes a gigantic flaming hole in the Turkmenistan desert, a museum of unclaimed airline baggage in Alabama, and, of course, Philadelphia's wonderful Mutter Museum. Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler spoke with them about the world's wondrous and curious places, and you can join the conversation by tweeting at WHYY Radio Times.
Ella and Joshua, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This book is billed as the definitive guide to the world's wondrous and curious places. It includes a lot of things, from cities to geographic features. Ella, tell me about some of your favorite places in the book.
The ones that appeal most to me are the ones that are things built by individuals who wake up one morning with sudden drive or inspiration and then decide to spend the next 40 years building a cathedral or hand building a castle. These people who are so driven, who devote themselves to this one pursuit. I love those. There's a guy in Madrid who's a former monk, Don Justo, and he decided to build a cathedral by hand. That was his motivation. That was his life from there on in, and he's still doing it. He must be in his 90s by now.
And Joshua, do you have a favorite in this book?
I have 700 favorites. do I have a favorite? Well, I'm enamored with a strange invention that was invented in 1851 by an English surgeon named George Meriwether, who at the time thought he had cracked the problem of how to predict the weather. And his solution was to he had noticed that freshwater leeches, those slimy animals, get really agitated before a big storm. So he thought, let me build a weather prediction machine that would use freshwater leeches. He called it the Tempest Prognosticator, and he said it was going to revolutionize meteorology. It didn't. but you can still find one, a working, so to speak, model on display in this one of these tiny little museums that is the kind of thing Atlas Obscura loves to celebrate. It's called Barometer World, and it's in Devon, England.
And how do you feel about trips to, say, the Eiffel Tower or the Great Wall of China? Those things aren't in your book, but what do you think about people traveling to them? Are those like, should go to those things and then go to this other cool stuff? Or do you feel like people are really missing out?
I don't look down on those places just because they're been there, done that kind of places. I mean, there is a lot of information about them, and you can look up 6,000 reviews on TripAdvisor if you want to know what it's like to go to the Eiffel Tower. But I think going to those places in conjunction with these hidden wonders, it makes for a nice combination to see what is out there that's being marketed as the travel destinations and then what is out there that you can discover for yourself.
And sometimes if you're like, you know, really just don't want to wait in the hour line at the Uffizi Gallery, it is nice to know that Galileo's middle finger is just steps away and there's, I promise, no line to see it.
And let's get to some of the other hidden wonders in this book. One of the places that I was familiar with a little bit is the Weekiwashi Mermaids. There's so much information crammed into these four paragraphs. Ella, I wondered if you could read them for us.
I would love to. All right. Mermaids have lived in the waters of Weekiwashi Springs since 1947, and that's when swim coach Newt Perry developed an underwater mermaid show performed at a depth of 20 feet by glamorous women in bikini tops and fishtails. To watch the mermaid show, spectators file into a 400-seat underwater theatre built into one side of the spring. The lights dim, gentle music starts playing, and a faded blue curtain rises to reveal the water behind a 100-foot-wide glass wall. As a voiceover describes the mermaid's world, water as blue as the loveliest cornflower, as pure as the clearest glass. One of the mythical creatures swims the length of the window, smiling and waving as the tendrils of her tail waft behind her. The ensuing show is a lip-synced, music-enhanced retelling of The Little Mermaid, complete with handsome prince, evil sea witch, and a terrestrial wedding once the mermaid gets her legs. To breathe underwater, the scuba-certified performers inhale from free-flowing air hoses that snake around the spring. Fish and turtles are unwitting co-stars. Since the arrival of Disney World in 1971, Weekiwashi has struggled to attract visitors. During the 1960s, there were 9 shows a day. Now, there are 3.
It sounds like such a magical place.
Yeah.
Do you remember how that one came to you?
I don't, actually. I think it must have been submitted by someone in Florida. But what I like about it is that it is this magical place, but it is a little bit run down. It's been there for a while. It's gotten a little bit forgotten. It's past its heyday, but it still has this certain charm to it.
And that's in Florida. And then I know on the other side of the country, there are places like the Museum of Jurassic Technology in Culver City, California, the Pando, which is a grove of aspen trees in Richfield, Utah, that looks like a normal forest, but is actually, I read, the heaviest living thing in the world because the whole forest is linked by a single root system. This book really covers it all. Like you talked about Galileo's middle finger, and then we're talking about forests. What was the criteria for what could fit in this book?
I mean, we are looking for places that expand our sense of what is possible in the world. They reveal something about how humans work, how the universe works. They tell us something more about ourselves or the world that we live in. And just being weird is not interesting for us.
This book balances places that have powerful, personal human stories with geographic formations like Mount Roraima, an enormous flat-topped plain with sheer cliffs surrounded by a sea of fog that rises up in a remote part of the Amazon forest in Venezuela. Are there places like that for either of you that you think, I will probably never get there, but it's really neat to read about?
I hope that one day I will get to all of these places, although I'm realistic about it. I'm a realist. But, I mean, you know, one of the things to say is there are a number of places in this book that might seem inaccessible, but, you know, sort of one of our one of the premises of this whole project is that places that seem inaccessible really aren't always as inaccessible as they seem if you approach them in the right spirit with the right sense of mission. And if you decide you were going to go to Mount Roraima, I bet you could make it happen.
And since we're sitting in a studio in Philadelphia, I do want to mention a few of the nearby sites that you have in your book. There's the Eastern State Penitentiary, the Motor Museum, and I know for many people who live in the Philly area, those are familiar places. Those are like kind of obvious go-to, kind of quirky stops. Do you think that that's the case for a lot of people? Have you heard from people in towns and cities across the country who say, hey, that's not a hidden spot? Like, everybody here knows about it.
Well, there is a certain cachet that comes with knowing about these places, I find. When I give the book to somebody, I do find that the first thing that they do is look at the places that they're familiar with, the place that they grew up in or where they live now. And they want to be in the know. They want to be able to flip to the spot and say, oh, I know about that place. I've been there. Invariably, there are places in here that they haven't been to. And that's what we found when we were putting the book together, is that even places that we have lived in, there were places that we were told about that may be really close to us that we were surprised by. But it definitely has become like a little bit of a competition among Atlas Obscura fans in the community to know about these places, to be able to say, oh, did you know?
And Joshua, tell me about those words, Atlas Obscura. What qualifies as obscura?
Yeah, you know, when we launched the website, we really weren't sure whether people were going to get it. Like, Atlas Obscura, what is this thing? We have tried to define a sensibility. Ella calls it atlasy. A place is either atlasy or it's not. And the remarkable thing is that people really get it. Like, no, people aren't submitting the Eiffel Tower to the Atlas Obscura. What they're submitting is, I mean, this is actually a really good Atlas entry. Gustav Eiffel built a secret room at the top of the Eiffel Tower, a wood-paneled room with a piano in it. That's an Atlas Obscura place. And one of the things that's interesting is there's often an Atlas Obscura place inside of or next to or a part of some, you know, famous tourist location. And if you just know the right door to walk through, you can find it.
And when the two of you travel, do you go to the more common places, the Eiffel Towers of the world, or do you really seek out the Atlas Obscuras of the world?
Well, that's something that has really changed with my mindset in working on this book and in becoming involved with Atlas Obscura, is that when I went to Budapest, I sought out the desiccated right hand of St. Stephen that was in the secret room behind the altar of this church. It does change your mindset. And that's part of what we wanted to do with assembling all of these wondrous places, is it's not necessarily about checking them off on your travel list. It's about inducing a mindset that encourages you to take a closer look, to wander down that alley, to think about what might be there that you haven't looked at before.
Throughout the book also are shocking stories about sole survivors of plane crashes. And Joshua, there's one I'd like you to read about self-surgery in the Antarctic.
Sure. This is a sidebar in our Antarctica chapter. On April 29th, 1961, 27-year-old Russian physician Dr. Leonid Rogozov experienced pain in his side and began to feel very unwell. Rogozov was one of a dozen men stationed at the Soviet Novolazarevskaya research base and the only physician on staff. As the pain grew more intense and a violent snowstorm made evacuation by plane impossible, Rogozov confronted a terrifying truth. He would have to perform his own appendectomy. Lying on his back and using a mirror for guidance, Rogozov spent 2 hours digging around in his anesthetized abdomen as his colleagues looked on. Weakened and suffering from head spins, the determined doctor took 20-second rests every 5 minutes to gather his strength. Rogozov's journal entry on the operation recounts a close call. quote, "At the worst moment of removing the appendix, I flagged. My heart seized up and noticeably slowed. My hands felt like rubber. Well, I thought it's going to end badly." End quote. Despite the physical strain, Ragozov completed the operation and made a full recovery, going on to live for another 29 years. Some of the surgical instruments used during the operation are on display at the Museum of the Arctic and Antarctic in St. Petersburg, Russia.
That gives me chills. Why is that the sort of thing that deserves to be in this book?
I mean, that kind of is the definition of expanding your sense of what is possible in the world. You know what? When stuck in a situation like that, a person could pull out an organ from their own body if they needed to. And here's something, and you can actually go in and see the tools that were used in that operation.
And your book also includes some places I'm not sure I want to visit, even if given the opportunity, like the rat temple in India, where 20,000 rats scurry around checkerboard floors, fighting to get to big bowls of milk. And they are not disgusting to people there. They are, in fact, worshipped as an incarnation of a Hindu goddess from the 15th century. How do you find stories like that that are in this book that really touch on so many things, culture, history, religion?
I think a lot of it is taking a common topic that is regarded in a certain way. Things like rats, you would think that everyone has a certain opinion about them. And then you find these places and phenomena, rituals that treat them in a completely different way. I've found that a lot with death in this book. There are things like the Mary Cemetery in Romania, where the headstones are made of these they're wooden and they're blue, and they feature these funny epitaphs about the people who have died. And some of them even have pictorial depictions of their last moments. So it might be a guy getting hit by a car, but it's shown in a funny way. And that happens throughout the book. I mean, there's a coffin workshop in Ghana where the coffins are shaped like giant sneakers or a ballpoint pen or a tiger. And those are some of my favorite entries as well, is these ones that treat a subject that we think we know what it's about in a completely different way. It really changes your mindset.
Joshua, has it changed your travels in any way? Have you gone out of your way to see anything that's in this book?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, and have gone out on trips actually just looking for either places that somebody has submitted to the Atlas that felt a little too good to be true, or to just find new places that should be in the Atlas. So Dylan and I spent 5 weeks not that long ago traveling all over South America looking for Atlas-y places, and visited the last Incan grass bridge and the everlasting lightning storm over Lake Maracaibo and a place called Gocta Falls that was completely unknown until about 10 years ago, but is in fact the third tallest waterfall in the world.
Wow. And can you tell me about any of the places you went to track down that sounded a little too good to be true?
Sure. A couple. On that trip in particular, we had heard about these zip lines, proto-zip lines, that used to be strung across the Andes that would allow people to cross these big mountainous, these big valleys in the Andes. And we weren't sure if they really existed. And so we were driving all over this rural part of Colombia, asking people, where's the cable? Where's the cable? Do these things still exist? And we found what we think may be the last one. And it was just a giant, I mean, I think it was about 400 meters long cable across this this valley. And it was crossed every day by about 19 people to get back and forth to their fields. They made like little hooks out of old wooden branches. I mean, it was incredibly dangerous, and ropes,
yeah,
and slid across these valleys. And Dylan, in a fit of just misguided curiosity, decided that he was going to cross one of these canyons with a local, and did it. And thank goodness he came back alive, because that could have been the end of Atlas Obscura.
Yeah, that sounds like a terrible idea. Ella, where are you going to go next? Have you picked out a spot in the book?
Oh my goodness. There are so many, I don't even know where to begin. I have been to Japan, but I would love to go back to Japan and go to the Ueno Zoo escape ritual, which happens every February. The zoologists dress up in papier-mâché animal costumes and practice the escape procedure. Other zoologists chase them with giant nets as school children watch on. It's incredible. I would love to go see that firsthand, although it's only in February.
What about that interests you?
I just love, it's just sort of goofy, but it's very endearing and also sort of practical as well. So it's this nice combination of something that is very visually interesting, but also it's a sense of ritual. It only happens every February. So it's not like you can go there anytime and see it. You would have to know when to go. And that's the case for a lot of places in the book, is that you need to be in the know. You have to have been told or found out from somebody or asked a local.
Joshua, is there a place in the book that you're particularly looking forward to visiting?
Do you want to talk about going to the gates of hell and drinking a bottle of wine?
Well, yeah. And then when one day Dylan and I have vowed, and Ella, you should join us.
I would love to.
to sit at the gates of hell, which is one of our favorite wonders in the book. It was a place submitted by a user early on, and we couldn't believe it existed. It's a giant flaming hole in the middle of the Turkmenistan desert. It's been burning for 40 years. It's the result of an industrial accident. There was a natural gas bubble that was punctured, and the Soviets set it on fire, and it's been burning ever since. And it's just absolutely arresting. And one day we will go there, and we will celebrate the publication of Atlas Obscura and have a drink.
At the gates of hell.
At the gates of hell.
My guests have been Ella Morton and Joshua Foer. They are two authors of the new book, Atlas Obscura, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Hidden Treasures. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler talking with Ella Morton and Joshua Foer. Up next, comedy clubs in Philadelphia, the city's open mic scene after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. It's clear we're living in a comedy boom era. The predominance of Netflix, with its hour-long specials from comedians of all kinds, has caused a resurgence in the interest in stand-up. And with that has come an influx of people who want to become comedians themselves. But the road to being a polished and respected comic is a long one, and it begins at open mic events, where anyone from the general public can sign up, go on stage, and tell jokes. Some do it for a lark, but most participants are there to hone their craft, to work on material, in order to have a solid set that can cultivate fans and hopefully a career in show business. Producer John Ahrens was curious about the culture surrounding open mic nights in Philadelphia. You can join this conversation by tweeting us at WHYY Radio Times.
Philadelphia is the home to several open mic nights, usually held weekly at bars, restaurants, and nightclubs. There, you usually won't find audiences made up of comedy fans. Instead, it's a room full of aspiring jokesters waiting their turn to work out, as they say. I went to a Wednesday night open mic at a Mexican restaurant called Casa de Su Madre, and I spoke with open mic newcomer Marianne Beltley to see how it feels to be new to the scene. We'll hear our conversation before her time on stage and afterward. Let's listen.
You said you are not very experienced.
This will be my third one. In moderately close succession, but yeah, I haven't done it a whole lot. I'm excited to do more, but you know, yeah, just kind of trying it out for the first time.
What got you started?
I stopped going to school full-time, and then I realized, got a full-time job, and kind of realized, like, wow, just working is terrible. Like, I need, like, a hobby. I like humor a lot, and I like writing a lot, so I'm like, maybe I'll just mesh the two together. And then, like, I was listening to a lot of stand-up at work, and, I realized that was, like, a thing I could, like, potentially, like, it felt a little more like, tangible, I guess, to do.
Do you feel intimidated that there's kind of a close-knit community that you're fresh to?
Yeah, it makes me really nervous. Like, so that was a big thing also with my first time going in, especially going up, like, knowing that they were already, like, kind of friendly with each other and me just being like, I want to break in. Like, I'm not also trying to, like, I don't want to be someone who comes and goes. Like, I want to hang out. It's a club I kind of want to get into or be a part of, but also, like, a fear, maybe? I don't know. I'm also like, I laugh a lot or try to make jokes when I'm more nervous. And I'm like, they're going to think I'm so dumb, though, because like, that's not a funny thing to say, like that kind of thing. I'm always like way more aware, and it makes me uncomfortable.
As your next comedian is new to the room, so show her some love. Marianne, everybody. Marianne.
All right, well, how'd you feel about it? It was, what, set number 4?
Yeah. Okay, I didn't practice a lot, so everything that was wrong, I'm, like, not surprised for. But, like, I'm always more nervous afterwards. Like, I'm a little bit shaky, but it's cool. I also, like, have, like, mildly shitty lungs generally, so, like, I get nervous. I'm like, oh, no. Okay, definitely could go better. I practiced and it went really well, and I don't know why it wouldn't go well in front of people.
You think it didn't go well?
I don't know. I'm really bad at reading it.
Do you feel encouraged?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You're going to come back?
I'd really like to. Sometimes I think it's really silly. Like, I don't like telling people that I do it because I don't want to, like, I don't want anyone to know that if I'm, like, failing or, like, that I'm just, like, that kind of, like, anything like that. But, like, I know it's something I want to do. I know ideally I'd love to keep doing it and to expand and do other things. I feel mostly okay about it. I feel okay about it.
That was comedy newcomer Marianne Beltley. The following night, I went to Raven Lounge in Center City, which is one of the longest-running open mics in town. It's a favorite of the comedy community, and there I spoke with comedian Brandon Gorin.
So you just rolled up here?
Yeah.
Is this a typical night for you?
Yeah, it's my usual Thursdays. Been doing it 4 years now. I'm from Maryland. I drive up here. And, yeah.
You drive from Maryland every Thursday to do Raven?
Yeah, I do. I drive from Maryland every Thursday to do Raven.
I don't care what anyone in this room says. You can't convince me that ice cream trucks are not baby ambulances. I want everyone to know that. There is no way you can convince me that the faster an ice cream truck goes, the faster that music plays. That's definitely true. There is no way that's not true. Hi.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what maybe makes Philly's open mic scene a little bit different than other ones?
There's a youth thing. You're allowed to be weird. You're allowed to be weird, but it will still punish you if you're bad, which is a nice mix of things. A lot of towns are like, yeah, no, it's good that you're trying, but crowds here will let you know if they dislike you and let you know if they like you, and that's really appreciated. Once you get past the first forever of getting beat down by crowds, and when you start cracking it open a little bit, it feels like you've actually achieved something. And it has a blue-collar feel. That's one of the things that's cool about Philadelphia. There's art in it, absolutely, but it's a place that isn't necessarily as arty as other, you know, places.
We've had a point in time where the last, I don't write topical humor anymore because the last topical joke I wrote was, at what point do we just keep the American flag at half-mast just to save time and energy? That was a weirdly ominous laugh. I'm going to take all these tiny laughs and I'm going to build it up into one big laugh. It's fine.
You have to learn to love the bomb. Like, you have to learn to accept the fact that there's going to be bad nights, especially early on. And I think it's a self-punishment a little bit, but not in a, like, in a very sexy way.
What's your name? Yeah.
Discani. Yeah.
Cool, man. What do you do for money?
I work at IT.
You work at a pet shop? That's dope. What type of pets do you sell?
No, I work at...
Dude, it's been a rough night. Don't make this work. Could you not just agree you went with a pet shop and I can make a nice pet shop joke? It ties into the Beach Boys, which goes to the Beastie Boys. It would have been a great thing, but you took it away.
So what's the end game? I mean, is this just like you want to come
there
in?
There is no end game. You go. I have no plans. I don't play. The end game is bigger rooms to perform for more people. But the end game is performing. You perform to perform. You perform more so you get better at performing. But you're still performing, and you're still trying to do your best at performing, and you try to make people's day weirder or better, and that is the accomplishment in and of itself. There is no end game.
That was open mic comedian Brandon Gorin. After attending a few open mic events, I invited Ronald Metellus and Rachel Fogletto, two of the more seasoned performers, to join me at the WHYY studio. We talked about open mic culture and cultivating a career in comedy. Ron, let me start with you. How long have you been doing comedy?
2.5 years now.
And what got you started? What made you want to start going to open mics?
I think I always wanted to do it, but like I went to school in Santa Fe and there's no real comedy scene out there. And then I moved to New York for a job, and so I started doing mics in Brooklyn and like lower Manhattan.
I went to high school in Northern Liberties, 2004 to 2008. The neighborhood changed a lot by the time I was going there. And it's weird to like watch like a neighborhood just like grow and gentrify in front of your very eyes, you know. There were a lot of like BYOB places that opened up while I was in high school, and I just want to get on the record that Bodine High School has been BYOB for 40 years now. And this is just one issue of cultural appropriation that no one wants to talk about. But I'll bring it up. I'm not scared.
And how would you say the mics in Brooklyn compare to the ones here?
You could just do a lot more mics in a night in New York than you can in Philly. Like a part of that's changing now because I think the Philly as a scene is growing. But yeah, you can do 5 mics in New York. I mean, they're not all great, but you can do them.
In a night, 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rachel, how about you? How long have you been doing this?
4 years.
4 years.
Actually, soon.
So you're like a veteran almost.
Oh, no, not at all. No, still young, as they say.
So I'm a feminist, obviously. Grew up in a feminist household, thank you. I grew up in a feminist household, which when you're white, that's a fancy way of saying your dad left. And the hardest part about feminism is buying all these drinks for myself. Am I right?
It seems like an art form in which you have to be in front of an audience in order to actually practice doing it. And so it must be difficult to have to do that, to be in front of people without being completely confident that what you're going to be doing is going to make them laugh.
Sure. That's why it's practice, you know. It's like you train at a gym the same way. You don't always know if you're going to be able to do every exercise the right way, but that's why you work out, like what the mics are for, before you present it at a show where you're, you know, being like showcased or paid.
Did it take a while for you to feel comfortable with that you were going to go up there and there were going to be things that worked or didn't, or were you aware that that was a part of developing as a comic?
When I first started, I would get really drunk and then go up, so that helped me not care. Also, when you first start, I know at least in Philadelphia, a lot of the mics are kind of hierarchical, so like if nobody knows who you are, you're going to go up at like 1:30 in the morning. So at that point, you sort of just don't care about a lot of things.
I can speak to that. A lot of the open mics in Philly, the more established comics go first, and that could be like a list of 20 people, and then the other comics resent them. So
that's why you got to start your own show, and then you can go up earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
Ronald, when you first started, was it a goal to, you know, your initial goal just to sort of break into the club, and when you saw this tight-knit community and, you know, they all pal around, they all go to what, how many mics a night,
several mics a night.
I wonder what's the first step in achieving the goal of being a comic?
I mean, making friends is important, and I mean, like it's a difficult thing to do. I think, like, let's say you're going to 3 or 4 mics a week, you're starting to see the same people every day, but you're not friends with them, but you see them all the time. And like, that was a trip to be like, do I say hi to this person? I know who he is.
But probably like, know 5 of their jokes too.
Yeah, I could tell them, I could quote their jokes back to them, but we are not friends.
Is there a hope that the general public comes, and how often does that happen? Or are you trying more to play to other comics and get their reactions and their feedback?
Well, you definitely want regular people to come.
You need civilians.
Yeah. Cool if you can make a comic laugh, but that is not what you want to be going for when you're practicing your jokes. You want regular people who are just there to have a good time and you want to make sure your jokes hit with like the general population. Because comics are essentially just one in their head thinking of their set, comparing themselves to you. You know, and we've already heard a bunch of our jokes a bunch of times, and we also do comedy. I know for me, I hate watching comedy sometimes.
Is this for you? I'll start with you, Ronald. Is this something that you like spending your time doing and it's just a fun thing to do at night? Or, you know, is there an end game? Is there a place you are looking forward to in your comedy career?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely like to be doing this for a living. It's not going to happen anytime soon, I don't think. Like, I think doing open mics is just a way to get better and, like, build material. Like, until you have, like, a solid, like, 45 to an hour, I don't even think you should be thinking about doing it full-time, and, like, I'm not quite there yet. But I'm trying to, like, build the skills to be able to do that. So, like, what it means to make a living in comedy has changed so much over the last 15 years, I think.
And as you said earlier, it takes about 10 years to become, you know, a real legitimate comic. I've heard that before.
Maybe depending on the part. That was just the number I threw out there in my...
No, I've heard that. I think I heard Roseanne say that as well. Yeah, 10 years. And it made me think, like, wow, like, it must take a lot of patience. And again, this is something I find fascinating. I mean, 10 years to hone a craft, I mean, that's a long time. Yeah. How do you... you know, reconcile knowing that you said you've been doing it 4 years and it might be 6 years ahead before headlining a show at, say, the Helium?
It is what it is. So you don't do comedy unless you really love it. So it's like you kind of figure that out real quick when you get into the scene and go to mics. It's like, I think we all start off kind of like, oh, I'm not sure, I'm just trying this out. And then when you see the commitment that you actually have to put, the time, the effort, the money, you don't do it unless you really want to do it. So the time at that point is worth it if it's something that's worthwhile to you.
And what about the process? I mean, is that something that you actually enjoy, or is it hard?
Oh, it can be awful sometimes. You want to just blow your brains out. But
it's very it's trying on your self-esteem. So you have to go into work the next day and you're just like spooked from bombing.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, I mean, it's part of it, though. It makes you better. I mean, it's like, even I've had like calculated sets where I'm like, oh, like, I know this, that'll work. And then, like, years into it, I've had like a terrible bomb and I'm like, what am I doing? Why have I wasted so much time? But it just, it's part of it. It just makes you better.
Ronald, how about your family? Are they enthusiastic and encouraging, or yeah, how do they receive the, you know, knowing that you do this at night?
My mom, I would say begrudging acceptance. I would say my brother is really supportive, and my friends are too. I think like one thing you realize, like doing comedy for like a couple of years, is eventually you'll wean your friends off of wanting to come to your shows, or you just have to like space it out.
How about you, Rachel?
My mom is actually really supportive. She comes to a lot of my shows, and at first it was weird, but she's actually really cool about it. And now, like, she knows a lot of comedians from going to my shows, and they all want to talk to her whenever she's there. So I'm lucky in that sense, you know, that she's not discouraging me.
I'm guessing you've probably seen people improve over time. I'm sure you have felt that you yourself have improved. Otherwise, maybe you wouldn't be doing it anymore. But, I mean, in general, do people improve just by doing it more, Ronald?
That's some of the most, like, fun times, is to see your friends get better over the mm-hmm. course of, like, months. And then some of the saddest times is, like, you watch someone and it's like, oh, you've been doing that joke for, oh, we've been doing this 3 years. You've been doing that joke for 3 years. And it still isn't funny.
Yeah.
Or you see someone who's like, I'm a college kid, I don't know what I'm doing. And then as they like come into their own, like mm-hmm. there are a couple people that come to mind who have gotten so much more funny over the last year. And that's the best thing to see.
That was my conversation with Philadelphia comedians Ronald Metellus and Rachel Fogletto. I'm John Ahrens.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.